Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we take a look at sexual harassment and abuse in the restaurant industry. We speak with service industry leader Tyler Chauvin, who's confronted sexual harassment directly over the course of her career. Tyler has become an unapologetic voice for change.
You combine that like naivety with self-negative reinforcement, societal negative reinforcement, you're kind of just setting women especially up to feel insecure.
Then we speak with Times-Picayune and NOLA.com reporter Brett Anderson, who made national headlines with his expose examining the culture of sexual misconduct in restaurants across New Orleans.
You know, it dawned on me that these women went to work expecting to be disrespected. And then I realized, I'm like, that's wrong. You know, I mean, that's terrible. That's just terrible.
That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Declaring that she had just signed Larry Nassar's death warrant, Ingham County Circuit Court Judge Rosemarie Aquilina has sentenced the former sports doctor to up to 40 to 175 years in prison. Nassar sexually molested scores of young women and girls who were his patients when he worked for Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics. Some of the survivors are Olympic gold medalists. Nassar apologized to his accusers, but the judge said she didn't buy it. She expressed disgust as she read out loud a letter in which he said he was a good doctor who was manipulated into pleading guilty to charges. The judge said Nassar doesn't get it. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports on what the 40 to 175-year sentence means for the ex-Olympic team sports doctor.
The minimum sentence that the judge gave him, those 40 years, that fits the plea agreement. So that means Nassar cannot withdraw his guilty plea. If he was able to withdraw his guilty plea, that could trigger a whole new trial. So this, for all intents and purposes, is over after hearing from 150-plus women and girls over 7 days.
Kate Wells reporting, both the assistant attorney general and the judge also had scathing words for those they say protected. Who protected Nassar? They include coaches and senior administrators at Michigan State and USA Gymnastics. Rockets from Syria have hit a mosque and a house in a Turkish border town today. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports the provincial government reports the attack left two people dead and 11 wounded.
The rockets crossed the border at the town of Kilis, and the governor's office says the rocket that hit a private home left four children among the wounded. The attacks come after Turkey launched a military operation against Syrian Kurdish fighters in northwest Syria. Turkey sees the Kurdish fighters as terrorists, despite the fact that the U.S. has trained and armed them for the battle against ISIS in Syria. Turkey's president says the operation will continue until the border area is cleared of Kurdish fighters and ISIS militants. Washington has urged a speedy end to the operation. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Elton John is embarking on a farewell tour around the world. NPR's Andrew Limbong says the 70-year-old music icon has announced he's retiring from touring.
Elton John says he wants to stop touring and spend time with his husband and two kids.
In 2015, David and I sat down with their school schedule, and I thought, I don't want to miss too much of this.
Elton John has been playing shows and touring since the 60s. In 2013, he told WHYY's Fresh Air that even though he appreciates that lifestyle,
no matter where I am in the world, I always look forward to coming home because that's where I want to be at this stage of my life.
He's the latest in a number of music artists who have recently announced their retirement from touring, including Neil Diamond and Slayer. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
The Dow is up 9 points. This is NPR. General Electric's accounting practices are now under federal investigation. The Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into a multi-billion-dollar insurance charge. This adds to setbacks to GE as the industrial giant attempts to reverse steep losses. San Diego-based Qualcomm is being hit with a $1.2 billion fine by European Union regulators. From Brussels, Terry Schultz reports a two-year investigation found Qualcomm paid Apple not to use competitors' chipsets.
For 5 years, Qualcomm gave Apple reduced prices plus billions of dollars to use only Qualcomm baseband chipsets to connect iPhones and iPads to cellular networks. EU Competition Commissioner Margrethe Vestager says that effectively shut out rivals between 2011 and 2016 and distorted a market in which Qualcomm already commanded some 90%. Vestager is penalizing the company just under 5% of last year's turnover.
Yes, it's a high fine, I do hope that it has a deterrent effect.
Apple will not face any legal repercussions for taking part in the illegal deal. Qualcomm says the agreement did not break EU law, nor affect consumer choice, and it will appeal. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Starting at the end of February, Hyundai will recall nearly 88,000 vehicles in the U.S. to address a potential anti-lock brake defect that could lead to a fire. Certain Sonatas and Azeros dating back to 2006 are affected. The Dow is up 15 points at 26,226. NASDAQ is off 39 points. S&P also down 1. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bryant University, for 155 years, dedicated to educating and inspiring students to excel and become innovative leaders of character, prepared to make a difference around the world. Learn more at bryant.edu.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we're examining the serious topic of sexual harassment, abuse, and violence in the hospitality industry. Some of the material on this week's show may not be appropriate for children. This problem is not a new one. Having worked in the industry myself, I first experienced it when I was just 19 and found myself in uncomfortable situations in a California kitchen where I worked with an older married chef. Suddenly, in the fall, the topic became front and center, nationally and locally. The Louisiana Eats team had already been investigating this issue since the summer when we attended a thought-provoking seminar at Tales of the Cocktail, which aimed to teach prevention strategies in restaurants and bars. We'll share that learning experience with you. Tyler Chauvin, manager of Trejo, an upscale bar on Tulane Avenue in New Orleans, has dedicated her life to the service industry. A survivor of assault herself, Tyler has advocated for change in workplace culture to make it a safer, more respectful place. After years, Tyler finally began to tell her own story, one she'll share with us here. Locally, the catalyst that began this seismic culture shift came from an article about the Besh Restaurant Group, which resulted from months of investigation by Times-Picayune food writer Brett Anderson. Brett sits down with us, not to rehash old news, but to discuss his personal journey and what he learned about himself along the way, both as a journalist and as a man. This is a tough conversation, but one that's long overdue. So now, please join us as we examine sexual abuse and violence in the hospitality industry on this week's Louisiana Eats. First, we turn to a service industry lifer who's confronted sexual harassment directly. Tyler Chauvin is the general manager at Trejo in New Orleans. Like so many women in the business, Tyler has dealt with a culture of casual sexism and assault in the workplace. She's become an unapologetic voice for change in the service industry, and she joined us to tell her story. A warning to listeners, this interview includes a description of sexual assault. To begin our conversation, I asked Tyler how long she's been in the service industry.
Well, I started waiting tables at morning call.
How long ago was that?
I was 15 years old, so that was 17 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And I haven't really left since. So I started bartending at just a very high volume. I actually started off as a shot girl at like a very high volume bar in New Orleans and then just kind of made my way into it. And so it was one of those places, lines out the door, working, you know, 12, 14 hours a day. And it was just very fast. And so I think I acquired some of the speed there. And then I just kind of hopped around restaurants after that. And I helped Chef Ray Gretzky over at Rue 127 and Fry. I helped him open Rue 127. And then I started working for Pauline and Steven Patterson at Finn McCool's while I was doing my master's degree. And from there, I entered a USBG, like the United States Bartenders Guild, cocktail competition for like the new up-and-coming bartender thing. And I actually won. So they approached me when they were going to open Treo, and they had suggested – I just finished grad school. So they had suggested me coming over there and kind of trying to help write the bar program. And then next thing you know, I'm building the entire program by myself, writing all the cocktails, and then just really immersing myself into the culture of like cocktail making.
As Tyler became fully committed to the hospitality business – she began to recognize certain harsh realities about what it's like to be a woman working behind a bar. Now that cases of sexual harassment are making national headlines, Tyler shared her thoughts about how the public is finally confronting what previously went unspoken.
A lot of people are having the conversation right now about having to like just absorb a certain amount of treatment, abuse even. There are also a lot of conversations are talking about how women are like, they feel pressed and compelled to accept so much more hazing, so much more harassment, because you really want to be considered, quote unquote, one of the guys, right?
Right.
That's a big conversation. And so I think 18, really wanting to be a bartender, like really, really wanting it, made me really have to absorb a lot of that treatment. And I don't know. It's just I'm such a significantly different person at 32 than I was at 18. So it's really hard for me to like backtrack to what my mind was thinking, other than if you put your head down and you work hard and you don't complain, you'll get promoted.
You must have had all sorts of stuff coming at you from every angle, especially customers.
Yeah.
I guess there must have been one of the first times that you really learned how to handle customers with perhaps some unwelcome thoughts.
Well, I'm only laughing because I think I did more than just have unwelcome thoughts. Actually, I got fired from that job. So when I finally had made it to a bartender, it was really busy and they had bouncers on staff. Unfortunately, they couldn't always get to you in the really, really tight crowds that were in the bar. And this one fella went to go tip me after ordering a Heineken, and he reached – like he took his dollar, and instead of handing it to me or putting it on the bar – he reached into the low-cut tank top that I was required to wear and shoved it, like, into my bra. And so I kind of grabbed him, and he used a bunch of choice words I'm not going to use now. We had, like, a bit of an argument. I couldn't find a bouncer. And I guess he just pushed my buttons to the extreme, and I ended up hitting him.
You punched him?
Yeah, I did.
Girl.
And I got, well, it wasn't the – unfortunately, that wasn't the reception that the event got at the time, which was really unfortunate, you know. And I think that it speaks a lot to like the larger problem that we're finding in society as a whole, is that women are repeatedly being placed in these compromising situations. And when there's no other avenue for them to get out of it, they do whatever they need to do to get out of it. And then it ultimately ends up being the woman that gets blamed for it, even still. And so I think that that kind of leads into this culture of fear to, like, you know, fear of shaming, fear of reporting. So many of these cases go undocumented for so long, where it's, even if it's harassment, assault, whatever it is, people are really, really afraid. People, women, I know especially, are really afraid to report for that fear of being blamed for it somehow. And so, I mean, even when you have no other recourse, you're still finding yourself being blamed. So it's this conditioning.
Though Tyler learned to adapt to the industry's culture of sexism, she soon found that adaptation was damaging to her own well-being.
Unfortunately, I think the coping mechanism that I had following that was to be even more accepting of, I mean, that's a negative conditioning, right? So like if I defend myself, I'm going to lose my job, right? And so you go into your next job going, well, I have to make money, you know, and this is the industry that I want to be in. So perhaps, and again, I'm not saying that any of this is correct, but I'm just kind of going through.
I think
at the time where my mindset was at. And so my mindset was like, you know, you need to be more flirtatious. You need to be more accepting of these things. Like, these are things that are just going to happen, and you have to just deal with it. So all of that negative reinforcement just keeps going through your mind every time you're going into work. It's take a deep breath. You just need to get through it. Again, this is 14 years ago. I was significantly younger as well, with not nearly the amount of life experience and confidence that I think it takes to maneuver through the world. And so I think a lot of that gets taken advantage of as well. Is there's a lot of youth in the service industry. There's a lot of inexperience because it's a job where you can acquire the skills relatively quickly if you have the mentality for it. And so you combine that like naivety with just overall negative self-negative reinforcement, societal negative reinforcement. And I mean, you're just kind of really creating a mess for I mean, like, you're kind of just setting women especially up to fail at that point, or to feel insecure. I don't want to say fail, because it's not a failure on our part, but it's I think more of just like this refusal to stand up for yourself, or this fear to stand up for yourself, I think is best.
Tyler, there was a point in your life where you discovered that it wasn't just the customers that might take advantage of you with half a chance.
Yeah. So I started working in a restaurant downtown, and there was always a very playful, kind of flirtatious banter between the entire staff, front of the house, back of the house. But we really did. We hung out a lot. We went out a lot. I mean, that's often the camaraderie of working together long, strange hours, is you can't maintain these like friendships that you would that 9-to-5 people do.
Right.
You know, you're operating in a completely different sphere. So oftentimes, I think coworkers tend to they gravitate toward one another. And so we all went out for a coworker's birthday. We went out. We were drinking and really just staying out late, kind of living that like stereotypical,
absolutely,
service industry life. And a coworker of mine was very intoxicated. So was everyone else. And so I had offered my place for him to stay, because he felt like he couldn't get home safe. Made him a sofa, gave him a glass of water, put on the TV, told him, I was going to go sleep in my bedroom. And he ended up coming in and raping me. There was nothing that I could do to stop that. And that's, I think, the reason why I share this so openly, is because I really, really want women to know that, I mean, there was no way that I could have avoided that situation. Someone took advantage of my generosity and my trust. So that's something that I had a really hard time dealing with when I was younger, because I blamed myself. And, I blamed myself for drinking, for lowering my inhibitions. It conditioned me for a really long time. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't report it because I didn't think anyone would believe me. I didn't even tell my parents for the longest time. I was horrified by the whole experience. It's such a violation. And therapy, though, is this wonderful process. Like, this, I hate to use the word journey, but it really is. You start to really like move through things, and through that you can find forgiveness for yourself. And you can also start to learn that it's not your fault, Shift the blame away from yourself and onto the actual, like, assailant, the actual person that is responsible for violating so many different facets of your life. It's a lot. Like, the violation and the trust is the biggest thing. And so that's what I always say. People are like, oh, you're so brave for talking about this. And yeah, there's a lot of brave women that are stepping out right now. But there's so many women that have experienced sexual assault and sexual harassment. I've even had, like, friends come and say, dude, I'm so glad you said that. I'm not that kind of person. And I always tell them, I think, like, the fact that you get out of bed every day and that you still form, like, relationships with people, and you go to work, and, like, it's, like, the trust that you can form again with other people is so – I think that makes everybody brave.
That was Tyler Chauvin, general manager at Treo. We'll hear more from her later in the show. Coming up next, we speak with Times-Picayune and NOLA.com writer Brett Anderson, whose investigation shined a spotlight on rampant abuse in restaurants across New Orleans. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
Satisfying your Louisiana music RV since 1991. Join either me, Bill Bolins, or Mr. Lee Kleinpeter for the best in Louisiana music. Cajun, Zydeco, blues, swamp pop, you name it. we got a whole lot of rock and roll, too. That's Dirty Rice, every Saturday night at 8:30 to 10 p.m. right here on KRBS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krbs.org.
Later today on This American Life, you know who thinks that the Democratic Party is in really bad shape? The people running the party think that. Ken Martin's the chair of all the state parties, the vice chair of the DNC.
Our brand is toxic. People don't know what the heck it is. If you got 100 Democrats in this room right now and ask them what the Democratic Party stands for, you'd get 100 different answers. No one knows what the Democratic Party is.
Why they haven't fixed it, later today.
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips, inviting you to Funkify Your Life, Thursday afternoons at 1 and Friday nights at 9, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and also from Cafe B, featuring contemporary Creole cuisine with an emphasis on fresh Gulf seafood, served in a classic old Metairie setting. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events on Metairie Road. This is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. We're spending this hour examining sexual harassment and abuse in the service industry. Again, a warning to listeners. We'll be talking about sensitive topics throughout this episode, material which may not be appropriate for children. In our last segment, we spoke with a leader in the hospitality industry who's faced harassment all throughout her career. Now we move to a local reporter who made national headlines in October 2017 with his exposé on the culture of sexual misconduct in the Besh Restaurant Group. A personal note here. John Besh and his team have been great friends of Louisiana Eats. This next segment is not intended to be commentary on what happened. Instead, it's an exploration of journalistic integrity on a topic which is both difficult and uncomfortable for us all. Brett Anderson is a features writer and restaurant critic at the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. Over the course of his investigation, he spoke with dozens of women who went on record with allegations of widespread sexual abuse in restaurants throughout New Orleans. I asked Brett what prompted the 8-month investigation.
I got the first tip that someone in the Besh Group's corporate office had quit her job back, it was during Mardi Gras of 2017. That person was Lindsay Reynolds, who had alleged in an email resignation letter and then later in interviews with me that the culture at that company allowed sexual harassment to flourish and go unchecked and that it was too much for her anymore and she had to quit. And as it happened, the week that she quit her job, two other women quit their job, left the company the same week, all from the corporate office. One of those people had sort of worked between the restaurants and the corporate office. I also reached out to a handful of people that I knew worked at the company, say through social media and so forth. And then every person I would speak with, I would ask if they knew anyone who had a similar experience that they thought they might want to share with me. And it kind of went from there. Then, you know, you hear something one person says and you try to verify it by talking to others. And over time, it became pretty well known, it seemed to me, in the restaurant community that I was working on the story. And when that happened, sourcing wasn't really a problem. I mean, I had people approach me in coffee shops and reach out to me, you know, unprompted through email or whatever. You know, when people who you've never seen before, as far as you know, approach you in coffee shops to tell you pretty intimate things, it has this feeling of the dam breaking.
How did you feel while you were working on this? Your personal feelings. Were there things that shocked you?
Sure. You know, the individual accusations that I would hear were, you know, by and large, plausible. But it was, you know, there's an accumulative effect of speaking with so many women. And it was more than just the 25 in the story. I spoke with others who just feel like no one is ever going to believe them and nothing is ever going to be done about this kind of thing. You know, there's that side of it and wanting to hear them out and give them the benefit of the doubt while also being healthily skeptical as a journalist that people's memories are weird. People's, you know, some people exaggerate, some people aren't honest, some people see experiences in a different way. And so I really exerted a lot of effort trying to achieve that balance of understanding and skepticism. And then on the other side is having feelings for, in this instance, you know, John Octavio and the people at the restaurant group, and knowing that they have families, they have a lot at stake. They're people, you know, I've known those people for a long time. Most of the people I interviewed, I didn't know at all. And, you know, I have to say, I'm the child of a man who was a very public person where I grew up. My father was a politician. And I know from firsthand experience that when there's unkind news about your parent in the newspaper, that it hurts everyone in the family. You know, I was very, no one needed to tell me that. And so I felt like that was something of an emotional burden, all that cumulative stuff.
If you look at what you have done in your lifetime, you know, you have been an award-winning restaurant critic. You've reported on hard news things in relation to the food industry, like the BP oil spill and Katrina. Is there anything else that you felt was very different about doing this job other than what you just said?
Well, the other big thing that was a little different relative to what my professional experience had been prior to this story is just the long-term relationship with the sources where you're sort of establishing trust over a long period of time on both sides and how important that is. I mean, just the sources in general being so important. You know, I for a lot of my career, a lot of the stories I've done have been, you know, premised on my opinion, which, you know, I don't need to query anyone about. And, you know, without the women, there's no story. You know, without these people who are willing to speak, there's nothing to say.
Right.
And none of these stories that we're seeing in the press occur without, you know, someone, and often numerous people, having the courage to come forward and stick their neck out, you know?
Yeah. All of this takes an inordinate amount of courage.
And you know, the women that I spoke with didn't, particularly those that agreed to go on the record, you know, they didn't agree to do that in a period where they could have gotten cover, for instance. That's something that people talk about from the Weinstein story, from the other stories in the national press. Those hadn't come out yet.
Yeah. These women were just telling their story.
Yeah. And they hadn't seen by example, you know, what the impact that these stories have been having. You know, I mean, if you think of the literally countless now powerful men who have lost their positions in a variety of different ways for reasons of sexual harassment since October and September, it's astonishing. But these women had no reason to believe that that was going to occur here. And I think for that reason, it was one of the reasons that they were incredibly scared until the end and skeptical in some instances that I would ever do anything.
What do you see the role that journalism is playing in combating this sort of institutional misogyny? I mean, you know, the fact that there's monkey business in the restaurant business is not a new story. You know, an old German chef chased me around a walk-in cooler, you know, when I was 19 years old for the first time. This is not anything new, but it's new now. It's different now. What's the role journalism has played in that?
Well, I mean, to the point you make about having experienced it yourself in the past, and really no one can credibly say that who've paid attention or know something about the service industry and the food business that they were shocked, you know, that this kind of thing could go on, right? And I don't think anyone could credibly say that they were shocked in general terms. But I think that what the restaurant and service industry has to contend with moving forward is that the kinds of behavior that people are talking about now that we used to think of as normal wasn't right. And the restaurant industry, I think, is working through enforcement. And I think that journalism, and we're seeing right now, is using the court of public opinion as its lever to enforce decency in these instances of, you know, all the instances that we're seeing in the press. And I think at some point the industries themselves are going to have to change to stop the stories. If not for just simple matter of right and wrong, you know, of just doing the right thing, they're going to have to stop just to, you know, stick a finger in the hole. I mean, and if that happens, I think that will be journalism having served a pretty good purpose, as messy as it sometimes can be. The thing I'm more concerned about, and is one of my sort of auxiliary causes here, is I don't work for the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know? I mean, I work for the Times-Picayune, and we've got a strong history of serving this community in a watchdog role, but, you know, we're a lot smaller than we used to be. And most news organizations between the coasts are also. And we're not seeing stories come out of the middle of the country. And you know, the piece I worked on cost a lot of money at the end of the day, right? Like, I don't work for free, and I wasn't doing a lot of other stuff. And while I was working on this, it just happened that there was, like, the planets aligned that allowed me the space to work on this particular story. I work in a city where restaurants are a huge part of the public identity, and I work for people I've worked with for a long time who trust me, I trust them, you know, all of that. And there's just not that many places where those factors are going to come into alignment. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect journalism to play a role in this outside of these glamour businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what you do if you work at a used sales lot in Wichita and have been harassed for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do when you work at a, you know, as a waitress at a diner in Maine, in Oklahoma, whatever, and work for someone who's been harassing people for years. You know, what do you do? So I don't, it's for that reason that I actually don't think journalism is the solution here. Mm-hmm. Because not that many communities have access to that many journalists or to news organizations that have a big enough audience that it's going to result in some kind of consequence.
So, Brett, let's talk about after the piece was published. Were you surprised by the enormity of the consequences?
People have asked me what surprised me about this. The thing that surprised me was a realization that I had at one point, where after talking to what at this point was countless different women in the industry about their experiences with harassment, and you know, it dawned on me that these women went to work expecting to be disrespected. And that is an expectation that they had developed before, in many cases, they worked for this particular restaurant group. This was just something that they had learned to expect from being in this particular industry. And I realized that I kind of expected that of them, too. You know, like, yeah, you work in a restaurant, there's going to be it's going to be kind of grabby, right? Like, and then I realized, I'm like, that's wrong. You know, I mean, that's terrible. That's just terrible. And that was kind of the big surprise for me, was that sort of intellectual breakthrough on my side, realizing how normalized it had been, even in my own brain. You know, like, yeah, of course waitresses are going to be, and hostesses and whatever it is, are going to be subject to a certain amount of leering, a certain amount of, you know, and there's nothing right about that, you know? And so I'll admit, you know, I guess in that way I was part of the problem. I mean, I didn't, before this story, I didn't think that we needed to be marching on the streets for the rights of service industry workers about this particular stuff. I mean, I you know, I don't know what to do with that.
Well, thank you, Brett. You've got two sons and I've got a daughter, and I don't think either of us want them to be in a world where that's acceptable.
Yeah, we can agree on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brett Anderson, features writer and restaurant critic at the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. While reporters like Brett Anderson helped spark a national reckoning, it's only the beginning of the conversation. Long before the Me Too movement became mainstream, organizations across the world have been working to confront the endemic problem of sexual abuse. In the summer of 2017, the annual Spirits Convention, Tales of the Cocktail, hosted a seminar presented by a group called Green Dot Etc., now known as Altruistic. The seminar focused on strategies to prevent sexual violence in restaurants, bars, and beyond. Originally created for a college setting, the Green Dot program has expanded its trainings to include high school, military, and local communities. For Tales, Green Dot adapted its program even further so that it would be accessible for service industry professionals. Leading the workshop was Kristen Parks, Vice President of Programs.
Good morning, everybody. I'm really excited to be here with you all this week.
We now present Kristen's seminar at Tales of the Cocktail, edited for Time. A warning to listeners, her presentation includes a description of sexual assault. After introducing herself, Kristen began by explaining that each week she takes a moment to connect to and remember why she's dedicated her life to Green Dot's work.
One was a moment that happened when I was 16 years old. When I was 16 years old, I got my first real job at this fast food restaurant in my community, and I was excited. Like, I couldn't wait. It made me feel so grown up to have this real job. It made me feel so grown up that I was one of only two other minors that worked there. The majority of the people who worked there were adults. And I loved my job. I loved making sandwiches. I loved working the drive-through. Like, I just loved my job. And I enjoyed the people I worked with, and I enjoyed getting to see my community every day. About 6 months into working this job, I was raped by a male coworker. He was 24 at the time, 8 years older than I am. And at that point in my life, no one had any real conversations with me about sexual assault. And so when it happened, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to react or respond, so I didn't do anything. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell my sisters. I didn't tell my best friends. I told nobody what happened. 3 months after I was assaulted, this man left this job. And I came into work after he was gone, and there were several women who were my friends in the break room talking. And when I came in, they were talking about how relieved they were that this man wasn't there anymore. And then when they saw me, they looked at me and said, "He said a bunch of things that made us worry he might hurt you. Thank God he left before he did." And I don't know what the angriest you've ever been in your life is, but I wanted to run screaming from that building, because all I could think in that moment was that these women had information that could have kept me safe. That they could have warned me, they could have confronted him, they could have done something, and for whatever reason they didn't, and that bad thing that they were worried about had already happened. And I didn't know what to do about that. I didn't know what to do about that anger. And so I just clung to it for a few years until I was in therapy when I was in college, which I'll always be thankful to my therapist, as she helped me work through all of my stuff. And one of the things we talked about was my anger around my assault, my anger around the reactions of these women. And as we began talking about it, I could not understand why. Why didn't they help me? Why didn't they say something? Is it because they really weren't my friends? Is it because they didn't really care about me at all? And so as we started talking about it, one of the things that came up was clearly they did care. They were relieved he was gone. They were glad he wasn't there anymore because they thought I might get hurt. So it was not a lack of compassion or caring that kept them from acting. So one of the reasons I do this work is I fundamentally believe most human beings are good, decent people. We don't want people in our lives to get hurt. We don't want people in our lives to be assaulted. And we don't always know what to do. Sometimes it's hard and difficult to do something, even when we want to. In different situations, in different contexts, we have different barriers that might come up for us. There are three different types of barriers. The first one is personal. So these are things about your personality. So if you're really shy, if you're introverted, if you hate conflict, if you don't like to be the center of attention, then when you see something happening, especially between people that you don't know, that's going to make it more challenging for you to do it. The second category of barriers are relationship barriers. I don't care how old we get. We have our friends in our lives because we care what they think. And if we think the people around us are going to respond or react negatively, they're not going to support what we're doing, we're actually less likely to do something if we think they're not going to support it. So relationship barriers, how our peers, our colleagues, how they react, can often define whether or not we're going to do or say something. And then the third one is organizational barriers. These are things that are unique to your establishment. Like, if you do or say something, do you work in an environment where a supervisor, if you get onto a patron for their behavior, is actually going to get you in trouble? And that's a barrier. Maybe a barrier is that you're new, and you're not quite sure what the ropes are yet, what's okay to do, what's not okay to do. Maybe you know that if you file a complaint against another colleague in the business, that that's going to create a lot of red tape for you. Or the person who's actually engaging in some of these behaviors has a lot more social capital. They've been a star tender for a minute, right? Like, other people know them, other people respect them, and they feel a little bit higher up than you. And if you say something, is that going to do some damage to your own reputation? Is that going to make it harder for you to find jobs that you want to do? Right? So you can have all of these organizational barriers that are specific to your establishment that can make it challenging to do something even if you want to. So what we want is for people to know that no matter what barriers you have options. So you don't have to get over your barriers in order to be able to help keep other people safe. You have other things that you can do. And we call those the three Ds. The first one is direct, which is exactly what it sounds like. I feel comfortable in some situations directly confronting the people involved. I saw how you were talking to your partner. That's not okay. I think you need to take a walk. You need to go calm down. Direct doesn't have to be confrontational. Maybe I'm checking in with a friend afterwards. Hey, I noticed since you got into this new relationship, some things seem kind of off. Are you okay? Do you want to talk about anything? Direct means I'm directly addressing the thing that concerns me. Then the next one is delegate. Delegate means you get somebody else to do it. If you don't feel comfortable in this situation, get somebody else. Maybe there's somebody who's better qualified to do something. Maybe if it's you, like if you're working and you see a patron who's getting into something and you're kind of concerned about them, and you know their friends are sitting at another table, go get their friends to say something. Hey, you might want to check on your friend and make sure that he or she's okay. Like, just get somebody else to do it. Tell management, call the police if that's needed, call security if needed, right? Get somebody else to do it. And the last one, which is probably my favorite, is distract. Distract is only limited by your imagination. Sometimes all a situation needs to de-escalate is some kind of diversion. I often hear of people talking about being the Velcro friend. So it's like if I see my friend and he or she is going off and I'm concerned that they might be in danger in some way, I just become attached to them constantly. So if somebody's trying to take them out of the bar, I'm like, I'm going too. They're like, oh, let's get a cab. Well, I'm going too. Like the Velcro friend, like I'm not leaving your side. And so doing things like that, right, to distract or de-escalate the situation. If you're somebody who thinks really quickly and doesn't mind being awkward or looking a little odd from time to time, distract is perfect. And it doesn't have to be anything funny. It could just be, hey, I'm lost. Can you help me find the next bar I want to go to? Or I lost my cat that I also brought to the bar for some reason. Can you help me find my cat, right? Like, you can strike up a conversation, do something to help de-escalate the situation.
Kristen Park's presentation on sexual violence prevention continues after a break. You're listening to Louisiana Eats.
This is Bob Gushereau inviting you to tune into the music of yesteryears every Tuesday night at 7. We'll listen to music from the great composers from the first part of the last century, done by performing artists then and the contemporaries of today, with a variety of music from my library and the library of many of my friends. That's the music of yesteryears, Tuesday nights at 7, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
On American Roots, we hear from songmakers like Memphis soul man William Bell about his tunes played by country and rock musicians. We're live with guitarist songster Chris Smither creating new blues, plus soul takes on Hank Williams and the Beatles' love of rockabilly Carl Perkins. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Friday afternoon at 1, right after the Blues Box on KRVS.
Feeling you don't know what that player is playing? Find out Thursday nights at 11 p.m. on the Minor Chord here on KRVS 88.7. We'll talk guitars, amps, synths, pedals, sometimes bass. That's the Minor Chord, KRVS 88.7 FM, KRVS.org. Thursdays at 11 p.m.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. This is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we're examining the issue of sexual harassment and abuse in the service industry. When we left off, Kristen Parks, Vice President of Programs at Altruistic, was conducting a seminar on sexual violence prevention at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans. She provided examples of reactive ways bystanders can address harassment, explaining the three D's of intervention: direct, delegate, and distract. Now back to Kristen's presentation.
And so as you can see, there are lots of different options that you could come up with. One of the other ways, in terms of shifting and changing a culture, that we want to help reduce the number of people who are impacted, is to create a climate, an environment, where it's not tolerated at all. We want to communicate two really strong norms in any establishment. Interpersonal violence is not tolerated. And each of us are expected to do our part, to do our piece in helping establish that as a norm. Norms are not established because of policies. They're not established because somebody somewhere in whatever office they sit in another state where your establishment is even located and says, we have a policy that we don't tolerate sexual assault. That policy only matters if it's actually being communicated within your place of work that that's true. Most of us can think of policies like right now. I bet you know of some policies within your establishment that are on paper but aren't really true. Like at the restaurant I worked at, employees were not supposed to eat any of the food. It was on paper. It was a policy. Guess what each and every one of us did? We ate the food. who took home bags of it, right? Like, yeah, there was a policy on paper, but that wasn't the actual norm. So how can we make sure that we are communicating that we don't tolerate interpersonal violence? How can we be proactive and intentional about the way we're communicating that? Maybe it's through a post you have on your personal or business social media page. Maybe it's in a conversation you have in staff meetings. Maybe it's just in the day-to-day conversations that you have with the people you care about. Maybe it's whenever you leave the Tales of the Cocktail this week and they're asking, how did it go? What all did you learn? And you're like, hey, I actually learned about this thing called Green Dot. Let me tell you for a minute what it is. And I also want you to know that I'm a safe person to come to if you're ever in trouble. Like, just I just want to have a conversation about that for a minute. Right? Like, so having conversations, posting things on social media, wearing the buttons or pins, donating to local agencies. If you have a DV shelter, a rape crisis center, or a child abuse center in your community, can your establishment do something for them to show that this matters? Like, can you put in a donation box for cell phones or have a night where 10% of the proceeds go to an organization that's helping to keep your community safer? That communicates that this is a value of yours. So as you can see, now we've covered proactive green dots and reactive green dots. There are lots and lots of things that we can do to help keep other people safe. And what I most want you to hear is you do not have to make this your whole life. This doesn't have to be everything you focus on and everything that you do. Because like when we talked about culture change, it's not when one person does one big thing. It's when each of us contribute our small moments to help keep your community, your establishment, safer. What I know, and the reason why I continue to do this work, is I believe the majority of us will. I believe the majority of us will go, yep, I can do one, or five, or seven. I can find my way to do something to help keep other people safe. We don't have to make this our whole lives. Just as you see things that concern you, as you have opportunities, can you communicate what your values are around this? So thank you all for allowing me to come in and do this presentation for you all. Thank you.
Kristen Parks, Vice President of Programs at Altruistic at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans. And now we return to our conversation with Tyler Chauvin, the general manager at Treo. As a survivor of sexual assault, Tyler has leveraged her strength and wisdom to speak out against abuse in the industry and to create a safe space in her own bar. I asked Tyler about some of the steps that service industry workers can take to prevent harassment and abuse.
I think the biggest thing is like to really just be keeping an eye on and engaging with your with the customers to make sure that they are comfortable. We've had a meeting about this very recently where I sat down with the staff and I told them, I said, look, if you're ever uncomfortable talking about this with me, you can go to Pauline and Steven. Like, we have a full open door where anybody will listen to anything. And if there isn't a situation with a customer, I don't care if I'm there or not. Call me and I will be right over, because it's something that needs to be documented and handled. And as bartenders, we are the last bastion of support, is the way that I look at it. When you're out drinking, you should be able to trust your bartender to take care of you if the night gets away from you and you've had too much to drink. You don't have to take responsibility for bad things that can happen when there is one last person there that can hopefully provide some interference for you. Make sure you get home safely. Make sure you're not being taken advantage of.
But it's not just hospitality industry professionals who can help create a safe space. Tyler pointed out that anyone can become an ally when confronted with the warning signs of abusive behavior.
The extreme example would be if you see a man carrying a woman out of the bar, stop him, stop him and ask him if there's a friend that you can call on her phone that can confirm that you're supposed to be taking her where you're going. And everyone kind of looked at me like, well, that was really severe. I'm engaged. I know that if my fiance had to carry me out of a bar and someone stopped him and said, is there a friend that we can call to confirm this? He would 100% say, here's her phone. I'll unlock it for you. you can call this list of human beings. You know, probably Pauline and Stephen will be first on the list of people to call. But I mean, like, there would be any number of people that he would, and he would openly do that, because it's just, it's a matter of like really, really taking care of someone, because you, if you can help, help. When I was working at Rue 127, there was a customer who had too much to drink. He was in with his wife and a bunch of other people. He ended up grabbing my butt. I was his server. And Ray Gretzky ended up actually asking him to leave. He asked me to step outside, and he intervened, handled the situation, and told the man that he had to pay out and leave. That's an example of someone who's like, who's willing to stand up and say, whoa, you know, like, I'm not going to tolerate this here. And I mean, that's my experience that stands out with him. And I didn't have to even handle the situation. Like, it was something where you go step outside, I'm going to take care of this. And so that's more of what I would like to see in this industry, is that like where when we need help, we actually have allies that are willing to step in and say, I'm going to take care of this for you, because it's already so stressful.
And as this whole situation that we all have been watching has played itself out, what are you hoping are some of the significant things that we will see be different in the future?
I have like a very hopeful outlook on it. And then I also have a relatively like realistic outlook, unfortunately. I mean, in a perfect world, we would have an equally safe space where everyone can work and feel safe and comfortable. The reality of it all is that to be a part of this industry is it really is an honor. I mean, like, you really are fortunate to be in it. You make great money. You make some of the best friends you can ever make, right? And so the acts that have already happened, they've already happened. And so those of us that are standing out and speaking about it, whether it be in private or in public, we are the ones that can try and help for the next generation, where at least they feel safe. You feel safe to report. You feel safe to come forward. I guess my hope is just that people can be more aware and be more willing to extend a hand to help, instead of just saying toughen up, because – Like I said, it's not time for us to toughen up anymore. It's time for everyone else to wake up.
That was Tyler Chauvin, General Manager at Treya. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef and Louisiana Wagyu in New Orleans' French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.